From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
We are sorry to say that we can't accept it tonight for two reasons.
Democracy Now! Rejects an honor from the Overseas Press Club.
This is a room full of journalists. We should be able to ask officials questions.
Confronts Richard Holbrooke and his journalist friends on the war in Yugoslavia.
I ask for your support, Tom Brokaw. Leslie Stahl, I ask for your support.
And rains on Tom Brokaw's parade.
And now, with the permission of Pacifica Radio, I will continue with the awards.
All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The two students who launched a murderous rampage on Tuesday were out to destroy the school, this according to the local sheriff of Littleton, a conclusion he reached after investigators found a large homemade bomb fashioned from two propane tanks and a gasoline canister in the kitchen at Columbine High School. The discovery also heightens a growing belief that the two young men had help from others in planning for their attack. Meanwhile, Colorado legislators have withdrawn two bills long advocated by the gun lobby, while Governor Bill Owens, a Republican, has promised to veto a third. The mayor of Denver, Wellington Webb, is asking the National Rifle Association to cancel its national meeting, scheduled to start in Denver on April 30th. Spurning a projected $18 million in spending by those who attend the meeting, the mayor said, "We don't want you here." NATO struck the headquarters of Serbia's state television last night, knocking the country's main station off the air and killing up to 15 people. Ambulances rushed to the scene. Reporters saw about a dozen wounded being taken away. The attack came hours after a Russian envoy said Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic had accepted the idea of a UN-controlled international presence in Kosovo. It was unclear if that meant the armed force demanded by NATO, and it appeared to be the same offer Milosevic made to a Belarus delegation last week. In a diplomatic bid to end the conflict, former Russian Premier Viktor Chernomyrdin held day-long talks with Milosevic. It was unclear whether the proposed international force would be armed, what guidelines it would operate under, and whether the offer represented a real peace gesture. NATO has insisted it must lead any armed presence in Kosovo to enforce a peace agreement. Milosevic has so far rejected NATO demands to withdraw his troops from the province and accept a Western-dictated autonomy plan for the ethnic Albanian majority there. And this news from Iraq: U.S. fighter jets flying from an airbase in southern Turkey bombed Iraqi air defenses in the northern no-fly zone imposed by only Britain and the United States after being targeted by anti-aircraft fire, this according to the U.S. military. Warplanes dropped laser-guided bombs on radar and anti-aircraft sites to the east and southeast of the city of Mosul. This news from Vieques, Puerto Rico: hundreds of funeral goers on Thursday mourned a man killed mistakenly by jets training in Puerto Rico for Kosovo, a death that has ignited protests against the U.S. military presence. Before the funeral on the island of Vieques, protesters infiltrated the U.S. Navy training ground, where David Sanas Rodriguez was killed, and erected a 10-foot-high white cross on top of a tank used for target practice. Rodriguez was a civilian security guard at the training ground. He died Monday when two U.S. Marine F-18 jets from the USS John F. Kennedy aircraft carrier dropped 500-pound bombs off target and hit an observation post. The jets and aircraft carrier were training for an assignment to the Adriatic Sea to relieve forces fighting in Kosovo. And at least 8 Timorese and possibly as many as 100 have died in attacks by death squads armed and trained by the Indonesian military. And this news from Geneva: the United Nations' main human rights body today condemned Israeli activities in the occupied Arab territories, citing continued violations such as torture of Palestinians. The UN Commission on Human Rights, holding its annual 6-week session, adopted a resolution which slammed Israel for detaining thousands of Palestinians without trial and, quote, the expropriation of Palestinian homes in East Jerusalem. While NATO bombs continue to drop on Yugoslavia, yesterday smashing the studios of Serb television and killing and injuring a number of people, dozens of leaders from NATO countries and other supportive nations have descended on Washington to mark the Western Alliance's 50th anniversary. And peace activists from around the world have also arrived in the nation's capital to protest against the continued air raids and to call for an end to nuclear weapons. With the arrival of 44 heads of state, including leaders of 19 NATO countries and 25 other nations, Washington, D.C. has turned into a huge high-security area as the Secret Service, the FBI, all federal enforcement agencies working with the Special Operations Division of the Washington Metropolitan Police have taken over the city's downtown for the next 3 days. A major protest planned today in Washington of peace groups calling for NATO to eliminate nuclear weapons from its arsenal. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we go now to people who are going to be protesting in Washington, D.C., despite what CNN and other news organizations say that there is no peace movement today or protest, there are thousands expected around the world protesting the bombing on this 50th anniversary of NATO. We're joined right now in our Washington studio at Pacifica Station WPFW by Gordon Clark, Executive Director of Peace Action. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Gordon.
Thanks, Amy.
Can you tell us very briefly what it is that you're going to be calling for today?
Well, it's going to be two things, Amy. Originally, this protest, which was planned many months ago, is one demanding that NATO denuclearize its forces and in the new strategic concept that they are supposed to be adopting to drop the idea that nuclear weapons are, as they call it, the supreme guarantee of the security of NATO nations. And obviously, with no Soviet Union anymore, with no Warsaw Pact, with no enemy to defend against with nuclear weapons, it is time, it's not only time to get rid of nuclear weapons around the world, but it's certainly time for NATO to start with that process. However, since that was originally planned, of course, we now have the crisis in Kosovo. So we can certainly expect that the protest will take a very large tone of simply a demand that NATO stop the bombing in Yugoslavia and that NATO get out of Yugoslavia and allow the United Nations and the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe to come back in.
We're also joined by Julian Smith, senior analyst at British American Security Information, which is an organization that researches foreign policy. What can you add to the reasons for why you're protesting today, Julian?
Well, last night, Jamie Shea said NATO has nothing to be ashamed of and a lot to be proud of. I think that pretty much sums up what we're trying to go head-to-head with. We don't feel NATO has much to celebrate. It may have done its job as a defensive alliance during the past 50 years, but it certainly has no role interfering in the sovereign states' actions within Yugoslavia, as we're witnessing right now.
Julian Smith and Gordon Clark in our studios in Washington, D.C. Julian, what does it look like in Washington for NATO's 50th anniversary today?
Well, despite the fact that NATO's currently conducting an air campaign in Yugoslavia, we still feel like the mood is relatively upbeat. I was surprised. Last night I was at a party for all the media. NATO did its best to try and persuade everyone that there was a lot to celebrate and be proud of, as I mentioned. There is certainly a somber mood that has cast over the summit in general, but I think overall NATO's going to make a strong push to try and talk about the things that it's achieved in the past 10 years since the end of the Cold War, and certainly what its plans are for, say, the next 50 years.
And finally, Gordon Clark, as we wrap up, I know you're both headed out to the protest. Can you sum up for us, number one, if you've been called by any of the corporate media to be interviewed, and two, what it is that you would say if you were?
Yeah, well, it's a good question, Amy. And strangely enough, while the media doesn't hesitate to report that there is no protest on this, the media has also essentially declined to call peace action and a number of other groups around the country, both national and local, who are actively conducting the protests. So it's confusing as to whether, in fact, there's not enough protest or just a refusal to cover that protest. And certainly, and we've gotten a few calls in recently, but the main point here is that NATO has taken in Yugoslavia the absolute worst choice. That war is always the choice that inflames the worst elements in a society, that kills the most people, as this war is right now, that destroys the most. You know, that the results of this bombing campaign already, in the words of Kenneth Bacon, who's the Pentagon spokesperson, that, you know, this war, this bombing campaign has not stopped one single act of brutality on the ground in Kosovo. In fact, far from that, it has actually predicated the massive ethnic cleansing and ethnically targeted campaign of ethnically targeted violence from the Yugoslav army. That is the result of this bombing campaign, and right now it is creating an utterly disastrous situation in Yugoslavia with hundreds of thousands of refugees for which no one is prepared. We are creating a nation of Serbians who will justifiably hate the U.S. and NATO for what they're doing to their country for decades to come, and we're undermining any of the democratic opposition, the nonviolent resistors who've been both in Serbia and in Kosovo for these many years, and of course have gone completely unsupported by the U.S. government or NATO. So war is the wrong choice by a lot and is creating a disastrous situation which is going to take years, if not decades, to resolve in the Balkans.
Gordon Clark and Julianne Smith, your contact numbers or websites if people want to get in touch with your groups. Julianne Smith, British American Security Information.
Our website is www.basicint.org.
And at Peace Action, if people want to join with us and our 27 state affiliates and 100 local chapters around the country who are protesting this war, you can contact our website at www.peace-action.org. Or for those of you who still use old-fashioned instruments like phones, you can give us a call at 1-800-228-1228. It's so old-fashioned, I almost forgot the number. That's 1-800-228-1228.
I want to thank you both for being with us as you scoot out to the protests. Gordon Clark of Peace Action, Julianne Smith with the British American Security Information Group. Thank you. Well, today we are going to spend the rest of the show focusing on how the media deals with war. Last night, Pacifica reporter Jeremy Scahill and I attended the 60th anniversary dinner of the Overseas Press Club. The documentary that we did for Democracy Now! That was engineered by Dred Scott Keyes, Drilling and Killing, Chevron and Nigeria's Oil Dictatorship, which documented Chevron's involvement in the killing of two Nigerian villagers last year, was receiving a citation for radio reporting. But we didn't go as guests to the event. It was about $125 a seat. We went to cover it, because we heard giving the keynote address would be none other than Ambassador Richard Holbrooke, many call the trigger for the current NATO-US-British bombing of Yugoslavia. He is the president's special envoy to Yugoslavia, who delivered the final ultimatum to Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic before NATO began dropping bombs on Yugoslavia. Well, Jeremy, when we first got there, we got a chance to see Richard Holbrooke in the lobby before he headed into the event and got a chance to talk to him. This is the question Jeremy had.
Just a second.
David?
The United States last week warned Slobodan Milosevic not to use chemical weapons, and now the United States, of course, is bombing petrochemical plants and oil refineries, releasing dangerous toxins into the environment. Why is the United States doing this, and isn't it hypocritical?
I just don't know. You know, you're asking the wrong person. I'm not involved in the targeting issues, and I don't know any of the details. So I'm sorry. I'm not going to be much.
Is the U.S. wrong, though, in doing that?
You're asking the wrong person.
But you're going to be ambassador to the U.N.
That's up to the Senate. You're asking the wrong person the wrong set of questions.
Excuse me. Could I just ask a question on another issue?
These are the wrong issues.
No.
And I got a chance to ask Richard Holbrooke about the Rambouillet Accord. And it was a question that has been raised by a number of the analysts we've had on. Right now joining us is Seth Ackerman. And Seth Ackerman is a media analyst with Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. Particularly lately, we've been focusing on Appendix B. Seth Ackerman, explain what Appendix B is.
Well, Appendix B is the security portion of the Rambouillet Agreement, and this is what's supposed to detail how the autonomy plan that the Yugoslav authorities and the Kosovo rebels were supposed to come to would be implemented. Annex B became controversial when it became widely known, especially in Europe, especially among the German Green Party, who's the foreign minister in Germany is from the Green Party, and the parliamentary delegation over there became very angry when they found out what the terms of the treaty actually were. Annex B basically provides for NATO to essentially occupy all of Yugoslavia. The terms, at least, are similar to what you'd find in an occupation treaty. The electromagnetic spectrum, all the broadcast media would be controlled by NATO. They'd have freedom of movement throughout all of Yugoslavia, not just the Kosovo province. It read as one mainstream German newspaper put it in an editorial, like a surrender treaty at the end of a war that was lost. And this was the agreement that NATO was essentially asking Milosevic to voluntarily agree to, as a part of an ultimatum: either accept or be bombed. I think that you could see the results going on right now in Yugoslavia.
Well, I asked Richard Holbrooke about the Rambouillet text and asked him if this didn't mean a full NATO occupation, but he said he wasn't there at Rambouillet. He wasn't the right man to ask, though in the talk that he gave, he said that he was the one who delivered the final ultimatum to Slobodan Milosevic, the Yugoslav president. Well, Jeremy did get a chance to ask Richard Holbrooke after his talk, and we're going to go to that in a little while and what that meant, because as we were moving into the talk, we were told by an organizer of the Overseas Press Club that Richard Holbrooke had said he would not be answering questions, and we thought there was something wrong with that in a room of hundreds upon hundreds of reporters. When we got into the event, as everyone was sitting down and we were hooking in our equipment, one of the main participants in the Overseas Press Club started off by saying that there was some good news for foreign reporters, since reporters have faced a lot of difficulty and danger around the world. And that one bit of good news was in Indonesia, where the foreign ministry had said that they were going to be dealing with reporters better. As I listened to that, I was quite shocked, considering the latest news we have out of Indonesia-occupied East Timor, where in the last week, aside from dozens of Timorese being killed, foreign reporters have been targeted, they've been beaten, they've been terrorized, they've been told by death squads, Indonesian-supported death squads, that they must leave the country. This was disturbing enough. And then Richard Holbrooke gave his talk to his friends, the media. This is what he had to say.
The kind of coverage we're seeing from the New York Times, the Washington Post, NBC, CBS, ABC, CNN, and the news magazines lately on Kosovo has been extraordinary and exemplary. Under the extremely difficult conditions in which most delicate decisions of balance and accuracy from both sides of a war are at stake, you are all doing this on a 24-hour-a-day basis with great skill so far, and I commend you. But I wish that there had been earlier attention to these problems. The role of journalists in such situations has been much discussed, especially since the Vietnam War, where some of your brethren were accused of contributing to the outcome by their reporting. I don't buy that argument. I know they're in this room, some of the great reporters of the Vietnam era, and if those of you who aren't sure what it was about want to find out, read the Library of America Reporting Vietnam series, which contains some of the best journalistic writing of the last half century and some of the great names of American journalism. Some of the reporting, of course, was inaccurate, and some was undoubtedly biased, but that's not the reason Vietnam ended the way it did. It has been argued that journalism made the American public impatient with Vietnam. I've heard learned arguments lately that if the press had covered World War II the way they now cover wars, we could not have won. I don't believe this.
Richard Holbrooke, the U.S. envoy to Yugoslavia, giving a speech last night at the 60th anniversary dinner of the Overseas Press Club. We're going to break for stations to identify themselves and then come back to his speech and then what happened afterwards. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. Listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman as we go back to the speech of Richard Holbrooke, U.S. envoy to Yugoslavia.
I simply don't find merit in that argument. In fact, the American public supported the Vietnam effort for over a decade, depending on how you count it, through over 50,000 American dead and untold costs. They gave the government time to succeed and finally realized, as senior American officials had already concluded in secret but hadn't told the public, that it could not be done. Then and only then did the American electorate act on its view through the political process and through their elected representatives in Congress. As a sometime government official, I want to encourage you to know how important your work is. I say that even though sometimes the coverage is painful to the policy process or even to me personally. That's the risk public officials must take. Although I'd ask each of you to consider the issue of fairness, especially when discussing people's careers. When a single story, perhaps leaked for partisan or personal reasons, can do enduring damage to someone's career. I would also suggest, and I know you've heard this before, that reporters pay more attention to the motives and biases of their sources, to be more questioning, and above all, to do more original legwork instead of relying on spin. I should stress that this observation does not apply in any great measure to the reporters I have watched at work in the Balkans. There's a vast difference between the work of those who see the reality on the ground and those who report the shadows and rumors of the capitals of Europe and Washington. One of your colleagues, who moved recently from Washington to the Balkans, told me of the immense relief he felt when he could go back to what he loved doing and what he felt he'd been built to do, report on what was really happening, not what people spun to each other over cocktails in the nation's capital. That kind of reporting, which we're seeing tonight on all the networks and in the newspapers every day and in Time and Newsweek and U.S. News and other magazines, has had great impact. I've had the opportunity to work with some of the great reporters of that region, Christiane Amanpour, John Burns, Roger Cohen, who I'm delighted is here tonight, John Pomfret, Jeff Smith, Kurt Schork, and many, many others, too numerous to name. They have done an enormous amount to bring truth to the world. They work as their predecessors did before them, only using modern technology, and their work has made a huge difference. And I want to say how important it has been and to encourage you to keep it up in the coming weeks and months, which are going to be extremely difficult. Now let me try to conclude by responding, but not to Peter Kahn's satisfaction, to the challenge he put to me before dinner, and talk about the policy situation itself. And I will speak, if you'll permit me to identify myself this way, as a private citizen who sometimes gives advice to the U.S. government. The situation in Kosovo is obviously serious. In my own view, it is the most serious foreign policy issue the United States has faced since Vietnam, and that is one of the main reasons I began by talking about Vietnam with the echoes, because we were honoring Maynard. The decisions the United States made a quarter of a century and more ago linger today with their consequences. So too will the decisions we're making now. No one expected this century and this millennium to end this way, but it will end with homeless people, refugees, people driven out of Kosovo, an immense reconstruction and refugee bill, whatever the outcome, and the very real possibility of additional and continued conflict. I do not think it would be wise or prudent for anyone in the government or out of the government to project how long the bombing will continue. Projections of that sort are based on no information greater than what's available to you. And indeed, when I read the best of the journalists, I learn more than I sometimes read in intelligence reports. Last week, for example, the Wall Street Journal ran an absolutely extraordinary piece by Tim Judah on its editorial page, which told me more about the KLA than 6 months of intelligence reports. I cite that only as one of many examples. And projections only come back to haunt you. That happened in Vietnam, it could happen here too. The only thing I can tell you is that whether one thinks we ought to be where we are today or not, and I'm not here tonight to discuss how we got here, but merely to talk about what the stakes are, it should be self-evident to every American and our NATO allies who are gathering tonight in Washington for a birthday party that has changed its tone and tenure, that the stakes now are so high that not to prevail, let us set aside momentarily the definition of the word prevail, not to prevail would be catastrophic. I don't know if the Yugoslav leadership, and particularly President Milosevic, understands that, but I can tell you that 4 weeks and one day ago, when I last saw him, I made clear to him that if my team and I left the presidential palace in Belgrade without him agreeing to an engaged discussion of the details of our offer, that bombing would follow within a matter of hours. And I told him, using words very carefully chosen, that the bombing would be swift, severe, and sustained. Perhaps he didn't believe it would be sustained, but he understood clearly that it would begin. We eliminated, before my departure, any possibility that this war could start as the Great War in August of 1914 had started in the same area by sloppy miscalculation and miscommunication, which was the case in August of 1914. And I said, do you understand what will happen when I leave? And he said, yes, you will bomb us. And there was a deadly silence in the palace like I'd not heard before. And then I said, well, I have to go call Washington. And I left, and that was the end of it. Now, many people didn't think we'd be bombing a month later, but I think it's now clear, I hope it's clear, that the bombing will continue and intensify if necessary. And so far it has been necessary. Esam Jordan told me just before I came up here that while we've been dining tonight, the airstrikes hit Serb TV and took out the Serb television, and at least for the time being, they're off the air. That is an enormously important event if it is in fact as Esam reported it, and I believe everything CNN tells me. If in fact they're off the air, even temporarily, as all of you know, one of the three key pillars, along with the security forces and the secret police, have been at least temporarily removed. And it is an enormously important and I think positive development. But again, I want to stress that none of us here tonight can predict how and when the Yugoslav leadership will change the positions that they now have. The most significant fact of the last 4 weeks, of course, has been the forced exodus. Now, most of you in this room, in fact, all of you in this room, call them refugees. If I could put back on an editor's hat for a minute, I would suggest that these are not refugees in the same sense that we had refugees in Indochina, where a million people fled communism to get away from it. These are deportees, to use the word of 1945. They have been pushed out. They're involuntary deportees. And they have changed Europe. It's the worst situation we've seen in a half a century. And the leadership in Belgrade is the most destabilizing group of people Europe has seen since the events that Andre Martin talked about a moment ago. And so we face a tremendous challenge. I hope that as you report, and you focus on differences within the alliance, which are there. It's inevitable that there would be tactical differences between 19 nations, and it's inevitable that people sitting in a room would have different points of view. If they all have the same point of view, that's when you should start worrying. But as you focus on these issues, which are part of the story, you also focus on the fact that never has NATO attempted anything like this, and the level of NATO cohesion tonight far exceeds anything that anyone in this room reporting the story would have predicted 6 weeks ago. I will make that statement flatly. No one in the room would have predicted this level of cohesion, and most of my colleagues in Washington would have had doubts. So there is NATO cohesion, and there is determination. And as those of you who watched Tony Blair's press conference from Brussels 2 days ago know, there is a dynamism in London, which is a very important contributing factor in policy. In the long run, one way or another, there will be an international peacekeeping force in Kosovo, which will include Americans. The argument over ground troops has been somewhat misleading in public because I don't think people have understood that we have already committed ourselves to sending in troops as we have in Bosnia after a peace deal. And the story will be with us a long time. When the millennium begins, we will still be heavily involved in Kosovo, for better or worse, and NATO's security interests in the region will continue. I don't see any way around it, and I don't say it with any great amount of pleasure. It's simply one of the burdens of leadership. We always say that America is the world's only superpower. But that's more than bragging rights. It's more than just saying we won the Super Bowl. It confers obligations and responsibilities and costs. We government officials need to make that case to the American public and to the Congress. And the Congress must decide, since they pay the bills, whether or not to go ahead. And the debate going on in the Congress now, on which I would stress to you does not follow party lines, I think that's one of the most important aspects of it, is of historic consequences. But I hope that we will see that the United States, the richest nation in the world, will continue to fulfill its obligations. The role you play, while often criticized and attacked by people in public life, is one that is truly indispensable and enormously positive. I thank you all for inviting me tonight.
Mr. Holbrooke, I'm sure my colleagues would back me up. I'm sure my colleagues would back me up and ask you a question. Mr. Holbrooke, you delivered the ultimatum to President Milosevic following the Rambouillet Accords, and you've said since then that those accords do not call for an occupation of Yugoslavia. Yet the text in Appendix B does say that NATO shall enjoy free and unrestricted access throughout Yugoslavia. Isn't that an occupation that no sovereign country would accept? This is a room full of journalists. We should be able to ask officials questions.
Not an award ceremony. It's an award
ceremony. I would ask for the backing of other journalists in this room. I ask for your support, Tom Brokaw, Leslie Stahl. I ask for your support.
Ambassador Holbrooke will talk to you later, he said.
And then Roy Rowan, president of the Overseas Press Club, introduced Tom Brokaw.
I've known Tom since 1975. We were seatmates together on Henry Kissinger's flight coming back from Beijing right after Gerald Ford's summit meeting with Chairman Mao. And a couple of times, I guess, during that 14-hour flight, we were invited to the forward cabin to have canapés and champagne with the State Department, with the Secretary of State. But most of the time, we were back there talking together. And I must say, on a 14-hour flight, you can get to know somebody pretty well. And I must say, I've always appreciated the chance to get to know Tom that way. Tom, please present the awards.
Interestingly enough, the trip that he was describing in 1975, I believe, included Indonesia, as well as where State of Secretary of State Henry Kissinger and President Ford met with Suharto and gave the go-ahead.
Thank
for
you,
the
Roy.
I
remember that flight very well because you, Bill Kovach, and I were the interrupters of the acolytes in the press section of the Henry Kissinger plane. We had the temerity to ask real questions when we went back to have the briefing. I have a point of personal privilege, I'm told, here this evening as we began. I'd like all of you, for just a moment, to take just a moment and raise a glass and think about our colleagues in far distant corners of the world tonight, so many of them in the Balkans, under far different conditions in which we gather here in New York, and think of the good work that they're doing, and if we can silently express to them our appreciation for their courage, for their tenacity, and for their utter professionalism under very difficult circumstances.
And then NBC anchor Tom Brokaw started to make the Holbrooke promise.
Parenthetically, let me just add that I did promise Richard Holbrooke that I would say that the young man who wanted to conduct the interview with him, Dick, did have an exchange with him before he answered a couple of his questions. He's agreed to meet with him afterward. I don't think I have to explain to a room of journalists that Richard Holbrooke is available. We did, in fact, identify one person back here in this room tonight who has either not received a call from Holbrooke or who has not called Holbrooke, but only one in the entire room, so far as I know.
Actually, there were two of us who hadn't received a call from Holbrooke. It's all about access, and we knew somehow that we wouldn't be getting much access anytime soon.
Now we return, to one of the most intimate and important of all the media, and that's the medium of radio, the Lowell Thomas Award for Best Radio Reporting, sponsored by ABC. The winner is Sandy Tolan of Homeland's production for Fresh Air. His report was entitled The Lemon Tree.
And after Sandy Tolan thanked the people who helped him on his piece on a Palestinian and Jewish family, he talked about the significance of the Overseas Press Club.
Finally, I want to add my voice to those in the OPC and CPJ who remember those journalists in their countries whose concern is to risk their lives, who have risked their lives, is to speak truth to power, whose life work is to ask tough questions of those in government, and whose refusal to become cozy with power has cost them immensely. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Tom Brokaw, NBC anchor and master of ceremonies.
Again, we have two citations. One goes to National Public Radio for its coverage of Israel at the age of 50, and the second is for Amy Goodman and Jeremy Scahill of Pacifica Radio for Nigeria's oil dictatorship. Now, the David Kaplan Award for Best Television Reporting from Abroad.
Mr. Brokaw, I'm Amy Goodman, and that was Jeremy Scahill who asked the question, who got the award for drilling and killing Chevron in Nigeria's oil dictatorship.
You got
and
the citation,
I, the citation, yes. The honorable mention. And we both want to say on behalf of Jeremy and I, we are sorry to say that we can't accept it tonight for two reasons. One is because we feel it's critical on a night like tonight when we're bombing Yugoslavia that journalists not agree to not ask questions of Richard Holbrooke. That's number one.
But Madam, may I just point out that he has agreed to answer the questions after the dinner.
But
that's appropriate. There are ceremonies and there are rituals and everything, including the press.
But we asked him questions before and we were told that there was an agreement he would not answer questions. But number two, tonight when the awards began, Mr. Shore got up and he said that we want to say there is good news, and that is that Indonesia has apologized for hurting journalists. The fact is that this week in Indonesian-occupied East Timor, journalists have been beaten up, journalists have been brutalized for covering the Indonesian military's arming and supporting of the militias, the death squads that are there. And because the Overseas Press Club was honoring Indonesia, we cannot accept the award and cannot accept the agreement not to ask Richard Holbrooke questions when we're bombing Yugoslavia. Thank you very much.
NBC anchor Tom.
It's a great country. It really is. It really is, and it's a great First Amendment. I mean, the fact is that we can all, I think, cherish it and know that we are in the presence of it at all times. And now, with the permission of Pacifica Radio, I will continue with the awards.
And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, you'll hear whether Richard Holbrooke did agree to answer any questions after the event, but you'll hear a little more of the event as well. This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
I've been waiting for something to happen for a week or a month or a year. Blood and the ink of the headline and the sound of the crowd in my ear. You might ask what it takes to remember when you think that you've heard it before. How governments lie to their people and how nations are driven to war. There are shadows on the faces of the men who fanned the flame. To those wars that have fought in places, we can't even remember their name. On the radio, talk shows, and TV, you hear one thing again and again. How the USA stands for freedom, and how we come to the aid of a friend. Well, who are these?
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman as we head back to the 60th anniversary Overseas Press Club Awards Dinner that took place last night at the Grand Hyatt Hotel in New York City. Hundreds of journalists dressed in black tie and dress were there, a number of them receiving awards, addressed by Richard Holbrooke, the U.S. envoy to Yugoslavia, possibly the next U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. And then again afterwards, Tom Brokaw, the master of ceremonies. Democracy Now! Said we would not receive our citation, the honorable mention for drilling and killing Chevron and Nigeria's oil dictatorship, because of the terms set at last night's event that we would not be able to question Richard Holbrooke and could not congratulate on Indonesia on how it treated journalists. But during the event, Tom Brokaw continued to talk about Holbrooke's promise that he would speak to us afterwards.
Our next presentation is the Edward R. Murrow Award for Best Television Documentary on Foreign Affairs, sponsored by CBS News. And I have in my remarks that were sent over by the OPC what for me was a very unsettling parenthetical comment. It says, possible ad lib for those too young to remember Edward R. Murrow or what he did. I will refer you to Andy Rooney at the end of the evening. Dick Holbrooke will be interviewed in one corner by Pacifica Radio, and Andy Rooney will have a corner to talk about Edward R. Murrow, who was no less than the godfather of broadcast journalism and the man who reminded us all that unless we do our very best work and remember why we're here, television is little more than just lights and wires in a box, and we do not want to allow it to succumb to that.
And then more awards.
Now, the wonderful world of business reporting. Category 11 is the Morton Frank Award for the Best Business Reporting and Magazine, sponsored by Merrill Lynch. The winner is a large Business Week team for Indonesia in Turmoil. And accepting the award is the Singapore Bureau Chief Michael Sherry, who has come from half around the world tonight to be with us. He will have remarks, and I trust there will not be additional commentary from Pacifica Radio once he finishes his remarks.
Actually, though I'm in the studio now and this is not last night, I do have additional commentary on that introduction. It's interesting to note that both in the introduction to our citation, the name of the documentary that we were being honored for, Drilling and Killing, Chevron and Nigeria's Oil Dictatorship, Tom Brokaw simply said for the documentary, Nigeria's Oil Dictatorship, not mentioning Chevron. And when introducing the Business Week group, it wasn't mentioned that, though they were honored for a series of articles, one of them was the December issue of Business Week that was called What Mobile Knew. It was a really incredible piece about Mobile giving excavating equipment to the Indonesian military, where Mobile was operating in Aceh, and allegedly that excavation equipment being used to dig mass graves. Unfortunately, neither Brokaw mentioned it, nor did the recipient of the award talk about that. But finally, after the event took place, Jeremy joining me in the studio right now. Jeremy, we did race over to Richard Holbrooke because we did want that question answered. We didn't want him to pull a Madeleine Albright like what happened in Columbus, Ohio at the event when Berger and Albright and War Secretary Cohen were there to drum up support for a bombing of Iraq. And Madeleine Albright said to someone she was trying to cut off, I'll speak to you later. And then she left the arena. Well, we went over. We saw that Richard Holbrooke was speaking with another reporter and then waited.
Well, it's interesting, you know, when I questioned him at the end of his talk and I challenged Tom Brokaw to support me in my effort to try to confront Richard Holbrooke with current U.S. policy toward Yugoslavia and the bombing, Tom Brokaw stood up and said, Richard Holbrooke is going to speak with you after this. Now, will you go sit down? And then, of course, as you know, security escorted me to the back. So we went after all of these promises and promises that Holbrooke was going to speak to us. You and I went and approached him and said, we're ready for our interview. And this is what happened.
Ambassador Holbrooke, why did you say you would speak to us if you won't?
He said he had to take his 89-year-old father-in-law.
Mr. Holbrooke, could we set up an appointment then so you could take your father home, your father-in-law home? When could we set up an appointment? You said you would speak to us. You told a group of hundreds of journalists that you would speak to us after. Just we make an appointment.
I have to look. Would you please stop
just tell
this?
Us when you'd make an appointment?
I mean, I just want to ask you one question.
Okay, ask me one question.
Okay.
One question.
I will ask you one question.
Yes, one question.
You've said since you gave the ultimatum to President Milosevic that the Romulan Accords do not call for the occupation of Yugoslavia.
I never said that. That's the end of that. Huh? You've got the wrong person in the wrong quote. That's your question.
Do the Romulan Accords? That was not my question.
What is your?
That was
question?
A statement. My question is: are the Romulan Accords a call for an occupation of Yugoslavia? How do you reconcile that with Appendix B?
I was not at Rambouillet. You'll have to address it to the people. Who
you
were
delivered
there.
The ultimatum.
That's
you're
the
familiar
end of your
with
question.
The text.
I did not discuss that detail with him. That's your question.
You haven't answered the question, though.
I have answered the question. Good night.
And that was it, as he said, good night. So much for the conversation and the questions I had prepared. Jeremy?
Now, Amy, joining us in our Washington studio is Sam Husseini from the Institute for Public Accuracy, putting out a lot of voices on this. And Sam, I wanted to ask you, Richard Holbrooke told me that I had it wrong, that he didn't make statements following the ultimatum delivered to Milosevic that the Romulan Accords are not calling for an occupation of Yugoslavia. What do you say to that, Sam Husseini?
I've heard him say that. He said that on the news with Brian Williams on MSNBC approximately on the 12th of April of this month. It's a very odd denial by him. Why would you say, look, Mr. Holbrooke, you've said that the Rambouillet Accords do not call for the occupation of Yugoslavia, and he denies making that remark? So therefore, he is implying that they do in fact call for the occupation of Yugoslavia. What an odd stance for him to be taking. You know, he said when he met with Milosevic that he didn't want a war to start because of misunderstandings like 1914, World War One. Well, I don't know a lot about 1914, World War One, but I know about the escalation of Vietnam in Gulf of Tonkin and the U.S. government using pretexts to escalate a war. And it seems to me that that Appendix B, which let me just read one or two snippets from it. Seth referred to it earlier. NATO personnel shall be immune from any form of arrest, investigation, or detention by the authorities of the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia. NATO personnel shall enjoy free and unrestricted passage and unimpeded access throughout the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia, including associated airspace and territorial waters. This language is calling virtually for the occupation, as far as I know, totally for the occupation, or at least giving NATO the permission to occupy all of Yugoslavia. This is either an insane thing to ask for a country. Every military expert that I've shown this to said, that sounds like what we told Japan to sign at the end of World War II. We've held a gun to their head saying, sign away your sovereignty or else we'll bomb you. Well, and since then, the administration has said they've gone the last mile for peace. I think they're lying, and they are clearly undermining peace. They are saying that they will, that they are insisting on a NATO force, not a UN force. I think that's a large part of it as well. NATO is becoming the cause for this war, not the remedy for this situation.
You know, it was an unbelievable situation being with hundreds of journalists at the Grand Hyatt with Richard Holbrooke announcing that the NATO forces had just bombed Serb TV. And as we went home, we were watching television, seeing that there were a number of people who were killed there, that Serb TV had gone off the air, though I think it's gone back on. Seth Ackerman of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, you've been covering Holbrooke's dealing with the final edict to Milosevic and also the bombing of Serb TV.
Well, first I'd like to say that I'm glad that some journalists were asking Holbrooke this question, because so far the mainstream media has studiously ignored it, and I think that it's key to understanding what's going on, especially in light of the fact that Holbrooke seemed essentially to be telling the press corps involved that we had to all brace ourselves for an escalation of the war. At least that's the message that I got from that. I think that when Holbrooke left Belgrade, he made a loud case in the media that Milosevic had been asking to be bombed. In fact, he said over and over again that when the Serb parliament ratified the decision of the Serbia's government to reject the ultimatum that he was giving them, that they were voting to be bombed. Actually, the Serbian parliament, he said, in fact, you know, we waited until the Serb parliament had finished its vote so that they could give a decision and possibly accept the terms that we were going to offer them, in which case we wouldn't bomb. What actually happened was that after they rejected the terms, including Annex B of Rambouillet, which, by the way, I think that Holbrooke, you know, if he claimed ignorance of what was in the text of Rambouillet, we have a lot more to worry about, since it was on the text of Rambouillet that he was trying to force Milosevic to accept on the threat of bombing. If Holbrooke waited until the Serb parliament had rejected the offer, he presumably also waited until after the Serb parliament had also passed a resolution saying that they were willing to accept the political portion of the Rambouillet agreement to give the Kosovars autonomy, if the international security force that would police it would, rather than being a 28,000 NATO troops occupying their country, or some kind of a United Nations force. I mean, the text had said that they were willing to consider some other kind of international security force, and there were many top officials talking to reporters saying that they were willing to accept a UN force. Well, that's not how the media covered it. The next day, Holbrooke went back to Washington. He said the bombs are going to start flying. We went the last mile for peace. And that was how you can read the story in the New York Times of that day, March 24th, and the Los Angeles Times, the Washington Post. That was how the media covered it. The fact that there had been essentially a counterproposal made, a counterproposal that the State Department, when questioned about it, had stonewalled on, James Rubin, that was something that one wouldn't discover unless one did some serious digging, which is what the mainstream media is supposed to do themselves.
I'd like to bring Robert Hayden into the discussion. He's the director of the Center for Russian and East European Studies at the University of Pittsburgh. Professor Hayden, your thoughts after listening to Richard Holbrooke.
Well, remember, Richard Holbrooke said that reporters covering the Balkans shouldn't do serious digging. He said that. Ordinarily, reporters should do that, but reporters covering the Balkans shouldn't do that. Look, I have to agree with everything that has been said. I mean, Rambouillet was an occupation agreement. There's no doubt about it. The government has been lying through its teeth. I, unfortunately, only have a couple of minutes. I have another show I have to do. I do want to say one thing about the bombing, a couple of things about the bombing of Serbian television. Just before I hooked up with this show, I talked to an old friend who used to run the Fulbright program in Belgrade and works in Serbian TV and had left the building 20 minutes before. There were at least 100 people in the building at the time that it was attacked. Most of them were technical people. We do not know how many of them are alive because several floors of the building have collapsed. The building, the murky pictures I've seen, which have been on the World Wide Web, they're carried from television. It looks a lot like Oklahoma City. This is an extraordinary assault on the media, and it is astonishing to me that at the gathering that you were at last night, Amy, that there was no protest against the targeting of journalists. And I have to say this, I am fully aware of what Radio Television Serbia has done over the years. 8 years ago, with 70,000 people from Belgrade, I was demonstrating on the streets of Belgrade against the Milosevic's control of the media and comparing Milosevic to Saddam Hussein. Having said that, had they wanted to take Radio Television Serbia off the air, they could have hit the broadcast facilities on Mount Avila, simply the transmitters, which they didn't do, and Radio Television Serbia is back on the air. But we do have here, you know, NATO went into this supposedly for humanitarian reasons. The death toll in Kosovo before NATO began this war was about 2,000 over the course of 2 years. NATO, as far as I can figure from the figures I've been able to get, has killed, and apart from the tragedy for the Kosovo Albanians, some of whom have also been killed by NATO, NATO is killing people at the moment at the rate of about 1,000 per month. If this is a humanitarian campaign, I do not think I want to see an anti-humanitarian campaign. Robert, it is a war against civilians.
Robert Hayden, thanks for joining us from University of Pittsburgh. Jeremy?
Sam Husseini from the Institute for Public Accuracy. When NATO initially threatened to bomb Serbian television, they said they were doing so for a couple of reasons, one of which was that it was warping Serb opinion. Your response to the bombing of Serb TV and NATO's rationale?
Well, I must confess that what we do is put out press releases citing experts on different subjects, and I had wanted to put out a press release on that very subject before it happened. I contacted the Committee to Protect Journalists, and while they had done some work on the situation in Yugoslavia, they had not, in the words of their staffer there, gotten around to issuing a protest for NATO's threat. So I think that a lot of people have fallen down on the job on this. This is obviously an attempt to silence what is not quite as an effective a propaganda campaign as others. But if, you know, I mean, saying that you're silencing propaganda is what every thug and dictator does to journalists. For them to become the commissars of what is and what is not propaganda, I think, is rather shuddering.
Sam Husseini, I want to thank you for being with us from the Institute for Public Accuracy in Washington, D.C., and Seth Ackerman from Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. Jeremy, the end of last night's 60th anniversary event at the Overseas Press Club, I thought, was a good symbol of everything that had gone on, a very close relationship between those in power and those covering those in power, sometimes even more powerful figures.
That's right, Amy. As Richard Holbrooke snuck off into the elevator, we found out that, guess who was giving him a ride home? Leslie Stahl from 60 Minutes. So it brings the whole thing full circle.
If you'd like to order a cassette copy of today's program, 1-800-735-0230 is the number to call. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion and David Love, technical director Errol Maitland, engineer in Washington Joe Gill. I'm Amy Goodman here with Jeremy Scahill for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! If you'd like to order a copy of the show, 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. When you think that you've heard it before, how governments lie to their people, and how nations are driven to war.